follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello and welcome to New Horror Express, your fortnightly podcast chatting to the best indie talent the horror genre has to offer, as presented by the Morbidly Beautiful Network. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and on today's show, I'm chatting to screenwriter and author Aaron Stearns about both his literary and cinematic career. Over the course of the interview, we talk about his earliest horror memories, how he got into writing horror fiction, and his work on Wolf Creek 2. Plus, we get into the differences between the original Wolf Creek and Wolf Creek 2, the visceral reactions that horror can provoke in people, and Aaron gives us some cryptic hints as to what he is up to next. All of which, and much, much more, you can hear right now in my interview with Aaron.
Hi, Aaron. Welcome to New Horror Express.
Thank you, Scott.
Okay. I didn't fuck it up, obviously. For the listener, we had a conversation about the pronunciation of Aaron's name, and he said he would correct me if I got it wrong. But
I grew up being called Aaron, but my Latvian heritage, I was given the name Aaron's. And it's not an easy thing in Western society to try and correct everyone every time. So thanks for getting it right.
Ah, that's no problem. That's no problem at all. I like to give everybody the proper name. You know, like I've often been guests before who have had, to a native English speaker, tricky surnames. And I try to get them right in the intros and stuff like that. So I'll remember that for when I record the intro and outro for this later. this is a bit of a different episode, actually, because usually at this point I'll say, oh, we've got you on the show today to talk about such and such latest project. But I thought we would do it more chronologically today. First of all, can you tell us how you first got into horror? What was your first horror experiences?
Wow, that's going back a long way. But I was actually terrified of horror when I was young. I remember a couple of incidents. One was, I think I hid behind the couch when there was an ad for Invasion of the Body Snatchers, or it might have even been the movie on. And I saw that moment when the little bulldog has the human face.
Oh, yeah.
And I couldn't sleep for weeks. So there was that. And then there was I always thought it was Night of the Living Dead, but it can't have been that. I remember seeing an image of two people sleeping in a bed, and then these hands come from all sides of the bed up in the dark to kind of clutch at the bed sheets. I always equated that with Night of the Living Dead, but it's not in that movie. So I don't know where I got that from. But those two things kind of gripped me when I was young and terrified me until I was about 10 years of age. And then something switched to me. And instead of running from those sort of scary images or stories, I realized I had to confront them, and I became fascinated by them. And I started writing them myself. When I was very young, maybe 5 or 6, I used to have a lot of dreams of death, I guess they were. I would wake up crying and screaming and saying to Mum, you know, what's outside the universe? And I have all these existential dreads. This is when I was about 4 or 5. So I kept that for a long time. But when I got to my teenage years, I started seeing horror as a way to explore that dread, not so much to exploit it or revel in it, but I found that the genre was the only genre really that was entirely focused on existentialism and on existence and on death. And although there are elements of it that certainly are about how spectacular a killing can be, for instance, like a slasher movie, that wasn't what I was interested in. I read a lot of fiction rather than watching movies when I was younger, and certainly in my teenage years, I was reading mostly. So I went back all through the Gothics, and I gave myself tasks of reading all Edgar Allan Poe, for instance, or all H.P. Lovecraft, or all Arthur Macklin, or any of these amazing earlier writers, Kafka. And I think at one stage I read, when I was about 10, I read Orwell 1984 and Adolf Huxley's Brave New World. And I didn't quite understand them at the time, but I knew there was something just incredibly interesting and a new understanding of the world in that. And the Gothics that I was reading also gave me this sort of view of the world that was, like Poe, for instance, is so steeped in death and life after death and what life means. And so I naturally went from that to trying to understand it to reading nonfiction works about that, and especially about Stephen King. And that led to me writing fiction and also pursuing an academic career to understand it.
And so when did your writing begin?
Well, I probably wrote earnestly when I was early teens, but I do have stories from when I was, you know, six or seven, I think I wrote an epic 20-page story about it was called An Adventure with the Australian Smurfs, actually, and it was me walking home and discovering this little village of Smurfs, which I was absolutely obsessed with. And there were evil Smurfs that ferried me off into space. I don't know. There was just a kind of a series of stories when I was younger that was these very ambitious, epic things. I noticed my daughter, who's 9, is doing the same thing now. She had to turn in a two-page story last year during COVID, and 25 pages later, she fully illustrated. She turned it in and kind of blew the teacher's mind, I think. I just naturally love, because I read a lot and because I isolated myself a lot, and I just kept generating these ideas and these stories. And so I wrote a lot of small things when I was younger, but then I started writing short stories when I was 13 or 14, trying to emulate Stephen King, who started collecting and then studying. And I got all the nonfiction books I could find about him. And then I probably started submitting short stories when I was about 17, 18. And it's kind of a natural progression, I think, in horror writing, that you start with short stories and you progress to novels, and then sometimes you branch out to screenplays and other things from there. But it's because I guess horror is in many ways it's almost a fan-driven genre, that not only do you read it, but you always want to write it and you want to have that effect on other people.
I suppose it's quite natural, especially in horror. It's quite natural to go that route of like short stories and then novels, because like there's so many horror anthologies out there, and there's so many like zines and stuff like that, you know? Like,
well, there's a good reason for that. It's a writer commentator that was very influential on me, Douglas E. Winter, is to say that horror is not a genre, it's an emotion. And so what you're trying to do is elicit an emotion from people, and that can be dread, it could be fear, it could be lasting horror. But that is often difficult to do in a longer form. You can generate interest and you can hold interest, but when you're talking about that very visceral reaction, it's often the form of that is often in short story form. So a lot of the great early works, such as Poe and Lovecraft, were in shorter form because that way you could kind of punch the audience in the face and then get out before they have time to reflect. Richard Christian Matheson and other writers were purely short story writers. When you look at novels and longer works, films, television, for instance, you can dip into that feeling, that moment of horror, but you then have to flesh out all this extra stuff to keep that interest. I think that's where, for instance, a slasher film or something, they have to keep doing the jump scares and various things to keep those levels of horror. But it's a different type of horror, I think. That's more of a I think there's a distinction. It's more of like a terror, an immediate kind of almost a physical reaction. But horror is the actual definition of that is it's a lasting dread, and it's something that changes the worldview of the audience. And that is, it's more of a changing of your understanding of the world. So something like that, you can kind of do that in a short form and then just leave the audience with that and leave them to fill in the blanks afterwards with that lasting effect.
Yeah. While you were talking there as well, it struck me that you were talking about horror being like, fan-based, fan-driven, and first you consume it and then you want to make it in some way.
Yes.
And it is, why do you think that horror is different from other genres? Because thinking about it, for both in literature and in film, in film you can take a horror film and you can show your horror film on a circuit of horror specific film festivals all over the world. And you can't do that with other genres. You can't do that with comedy. You can't do that with action. You can do that with westerns. You know, even sci-fi, there is sci-fi film festivals. There's not as many sci-fi film festivals as there is horror specific film festivals. And so it does, there is a community around it, and there is these structures around it that make it feel, quite separate from other genres.
I think it translates very well culturally. I think that you can extrapolate because it deals with fundamental human concerns. It's less culturally specific. I think that even though you can set it in a specific place and time, you can then extrapolate from that and something that's set in Bangladesh or even New Zealand, for instance, or Scotland, they can be set in those areas, and they can. There was a movie called Citadel, for instance, which was set in the Housing Commission towers in I think it was London or any English city anyway. But you could project yourself into that because it places itself so well in that environment. You can then project yourself into that. But the issues that it's raising and the fears it's eliciting in the viewer are universal concerns. And I think that when you talk about other genres like comedy, Western comedies can travel very well, but it's sometimes hard to really understand, say, a Norwegian comedy. I find sometimes you know, I want to understand them, but there's a lot that flies over my head. But when you're talking about horror, you're talking about tapping into human fears, fundamental human fears.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, comedy in particular is very culturally specific. You know, you can watch comedies from other countries and find them funny or find them entertaining or whatever. But I certainly know that, you know, even within Europe, you know, some European countries, like British comedies, don't go over that well. Or, you know, like, no. So like in Britain, often like French or Italian comedies are seen as too kind of broad and silly. And you know, like, you know, Swedish and Norwegian comedies seem kind of odd in their kind of their super deadpanness, and that can some people can find that alienating, and you know, so yeah, comedy is, it's very, the only truly universal comedy is slapstick. That, you know, any comedy that involves language, well, immediately think becomes
of,
yeah,
think of why that is, because it's that kind of wordless physical sort of humor. Mm-hmm. And that's why I say something like Evil Dead 2 translates so well, because that's a slapstick horror. And, yeah, and so much of horror really comes down to that fundamental physical fear, I think. And even though there might be dialogue, it's that we can relate to it very much on a physical and a visceral sense.
I agree with you there. And it's, and you don't always need to get the cultural references, I feel, you know, because obviously ghost stories work very differently in, say, Japan than they do in Western cultures. But it's funny, you can though, still watch a Japanese ghost story and be, you know, have a reaction to it, even if you don't kind of aren't aware of the cultural mores around ghosts in that, yeah, within that culture.
No, and I think that actually opens up a lot of the world, and certainly J horror and Korean horror, which has been very big recently. Mm-hmm. They open up those cultures to us, and whereas a comedy or even sometimes a crime thriller set in those environments might be a bit hard to get into. I think that you accept. I mean, one of the fundamental requirements of a viewer or a reader for horror is the willing suspension of disbelief, and so we come into this already open to the experience. We know that it's that's what required us. If we come in skeptical, for instance, then there's almost no point doing the experience. There's almost no point reading or watching. A lot of people, when they watch these movies or read these books, we know what's required of us, and we we're really open to it, and I think that helps with something that's, you know, subtitled, for instance. And we're very much willing to sit there and just to let it all wash over us rather than try and understand what's going on. I think that that dreamlike aspect of horror and some fantasy helps that as well. If you think about, you know, say Texas Chainsaw, it's essentially a warped fairy tale. And, you know, the girl gets taken into the insane haunted house and then escapes from it and is chased through the woods. And it's so much that nightmare scenario that it draws us in, and it kind of forces us into that mindset.
Yeah. It's really interesting what you say there about like going into with a kind of suspension of disbelief. And I really agree with you in terms of in terms of films not in the English language, in terms of like them being those cultures being opened up to you through horror and feeling that you've learned a fragment of that culture within those films, and that watching like a crime film or an action film or a comedy film or whatever it is from that same country, it can be a different experience, and the kind of the things you don't understand culturally can provide barriers in those sorts of films, but and not in horror. It can kind of melt those barriers.
Yeah, and it's not just in film. I think a lot of my apprenticeship reading was with the year's best fantasy and horror anthologies that were put out by St. Martin's Press. They're edited by Ellen Datlow and Terry Windling, and there was decades of this. And I religiously got this every year, and they curated what they felt were the best short stories from around the world. It wasn't just the West. I remember reading some amazing Brazilian and Japanese and even Indonesian, I think, stories in these anthologies. And it gave such a great kind of awareness of what was happening around the world, which is that diversity is central now to editing these anthologies, but it wasn't back then. Back then you had, in the 80s, 90s, you had the usual suspects, I guess you'd say, that would always appear in these anthologies. And it was very much the big American names and some English names. And being not from America or England, I liked that idea that you didn't have to just be from that, from those countries to succeed. And one of the problems about trying to be a writer outside of those two markets is even having the confidence to think you can do these things, to write, and that your writing would even be able to translate or matter. I think those anthologies demonstrated to me that that was absolutely possible. And the film scene in Australia was quite dead in the certainly in horror in the late 90s and early 2000s. There was a handful of movies put out. So once that started to open out and people became more confident about expressing Australian fears, for instance, and our experience, and not just living through the experience of, say, Americans, I think that just exploded.
Do you know why that was, by any chance? In terms of like the Australian thing about the kind of films dipping off, because obviously you had the big, in terms of horror, and both in terms of action and horror, you had like a lot of the exploitation films from the 70s and 80s. And
well, that was
why it kind of dipped in the 90s.
Yeah, there's been a lot of research into that, a lot of documentaries about that, and it's fairly evident that there was a very good tax incentive scheme, I think it was the 10BA, that allowed a lot of investment into films that would do well successfully. So popular films were made, and horror is popular. Mm. So in the 70s, it was actually possible to get genre films made, maybe even the early 80s. But the government here, as far as I would say, then wanted to regulate how we were portrayed overseas. So the exploitation films did not project us in a very good light. So they became cultural gatekeepers and then started to actually crack down on these types of films and get rid of the tax incentive. And then it actually became very difficult to make films. And even now, they're basically cultural gatekeepers. The funding we rely very heavily on funding bodies now in Australia to get films made. And I remember trying to get a number of scripts through them that were rejected simply because they were genre. And I think that's shifted, and I think Wolf Creek had a lot to do with that. But that's prior to that, you would actually get told, we don't make that sort of stuff. And that, I don't think that's as so much the case, but I still think there is a stigma against that. And if you try and get into, say, one of the writers' festivals here, you can't do it as a horror writer, for instance. So we're still fighting that kind of cultural cringe.
Yeah. I certainly remember from my interview with Lee Murray that she was saying it's very similar in New Zealand, that in terms of getting into writers' festivals and, you know, like, it's, there's that kind of literary fiction bias that kind of...
Well, yeah, and I've been told, to my face, we don't usually feature people like you. And it's extraordinary when you realize that institutional bias. And I've been aware of that all throughout my career, because I've always been pretty resolutely horror focused. So I came up against that at university. I was told that I was wasting my time doing dissertations on horror, and I was suggested to do other things, and I just stuck to my guns. And I found a supervisor that would support me. But that is throughout everything. And it's so bizarre, because horror has always been one of the most profitable film genres, for instance. And certainly at one point is very profitable in fiction. It's not so much at the moment, because it's hard to get works published. Kind of, they oversaturated the market with that, and then it became a lot harder to get things made. And they essentially got rid of the horror genre in bookstores and on imprints. So it doesn't mean it went away. It just meant that that huge glut we had in the 80s disappeared. But that's just something you always kind of fight against. It's almost like part of being a horror writer is that almost militant defiance to keep at that, to keep writing it, even though everyone is essentially telling you not to. And trying to get films up here, it's always a slog. It's always difficult. It doesn't mean it's not happening. It's happening a lot more now, but it's just surprising. We had a very strong censorship body here that filtered a lot of the things we could see in Australia. Our island status, it's an isolated island. It helps sometimes. It helped in the start of COVID, and it doesn't help with such things as treating its citizens as adults and letting them decide what they should and shouldn't watch. We get treated like a very closed market sometimes.
I mean, censorship was long and an issue in the UK as well. Although I have to say, over the last kind of, it's over the kind of 21st century, that's got much, much better censorship in the UK. I think,
yeah, the video nasty era in the UK was, it's pretty appalling, really, to consider that, you know, movies like The Evil Dead were bad. And it just seems ridiculous now when you go back and look at what they consider to be aberrant, you know, abhorrent, that its citizens weren't capable of intelligently processing themselves and realizing that these are fantasies, these are fictions, that, and not realizing that it can actually be a cathartic aspect of watching these things, that it doesn't necessarily elicit the same behavior in people.
Yeah. And I mean it also, like, there's all the other thing of it just doesn't work. It's like the the list, the films, I've watched a bunch of them, the films on the Video Nasties list, and there's loads of them that, are trash, that would have been forgotten by time, in 2 seconds if they hadn't been on the Video Nasties list. But now that list is kind of been canonized by horror fans, not just in the UK, but like elsewhere. So loads of those films have a much longer shelf life than they would have.
Yeah, almost doing the filmmakers a favor and almost eulogizing these films that actually don't have much else going for them. But that's the effect you have. So, something like Cannibal Holocaust, if they hadn't had such a controversy about that film potentially being real, the director was prosecuted for the death of his actors, and he had to stop the illusion and actually bring them out of hiding and say, "Well, they're not dead, we're just doing a marketing ploy." It's
Yeah,
just it's
that's true.
ludicrous. If you highlight something, it's worse than discounting it, I think. If you have a problem with something, and it's the thing I think for freedom of speech as well, rather than cancel it, for instance, just counter it. And that's what they could have done with those sort of films, and all they needed to do was denigrate them, I think, rather than make them into some titillating taboo, something that people weren't allowed to watch. And she say, "You can't watch something, that's when I want to watch it."
Yeah, that's
So,
true.
we all had to track those films down to find out what was the big deal about them. And often there wasn't much that was a big deal, unless you're talking about, the guinea pig films or something, which were insane. But mostly they were so badly done, and you could see how appalling the special effects were, and just think, what are they really trying to say? And it's not like any of these films were actual snuff films anyway. It's not like
No.
they actually were criminal acts. They were just shoddy kind of recreations of things.
Well, one of them is called Snuff. It's not a snuff film, but it is called
Yeah,
Snuff. And it's a
I
terrible, terrible film, but it does
know
have a great tagline where it's like, it's something about from South America, where life is cheap.
that. Yep. Yes, I remember that. Yes. Yeah, and so because it's got that gimmick and it's the first one to do it, you have to see it. And I think there was a story that Charlie Sheen saw one of the, it might have been one of the guinea pig films or something, and he thought that was literally a snuff film and turned into the FBI, and they did a big investigation, and
That's
of course
right.
it wasn't. Of course it wasn't.
Of course it
But
wasn't. Yeah.
just, part of us, I think, want these things to be true. And when you actually see these, when you see these special effects being done, and you see how kind of the artifice that goes on behind it, and you watch the actors in between takes joking and waving body parts around, and I remember the first time I saw Wolf Creek 1, the actual first cut of it. We were sitting on the couch at the director's house with the two actresses in the film sitting next to us, and so with all the horror going on screen, we could always just look across and say, "No, you're all right. No, you're all right." So that helped.
For sure. So obviously one of the things you're known for is you co-wrote Wolf Creek 2. You had a small cameo in Wolf Creek, and you also wrote a Wolf Creek novel, Wolf Creek Origin. So how did you first get involved with that? How did you first meet Greg, and how did you get involved with Wolf Creek?
That's was all through a friend of mine called Dan Austin, who I met on the first day of university in the thing that we're in literature together, literary studies and journalism. And he was a really interesting guy that spent 3 years walking around campus without shoes and had long hair. And me coming from very kind of staid Ballarat, I'd never seen anyone as kind of free and interesting as him. And became great friends with him. And we used to write fiction together and or pass it back and forth. And when I kept on with university after my undergrad and went on to master's and PhD and started teaching. But I moved back to Melbourne at one stage, and he had an office with one of his great friends from his hometown of Bendigo, who was Greg McLean. And they invited me to share some space in Fitzroy, which is a really cool kind of arty inner city suburb in Melbourne. And we rented some space out up above an old kind of, I think it was an Italian or European bakery, a really kind of old school mum and dad or grandmum and granddad kind of operation. And we had this really kind of dingy kind of space above them, with the only balcony in this whole street, in Brunswick Street. And it just became a really invigorating few years that we shared this space. Greg was already endeavouring to make films, and he got some funding through the Nestlé Big Break, I think it was. And he was already writing scripts, but I'd come from fiction and academic work, and I was presenting academic papers overseas at conferences and things. So I'd never considered film until I met him. But we started trading ideas back and forth, and I told him about this idea I had for zombies and why they should be fast, and I had this big theory about it. And he said, "Well, write it." So we wrote a zombie movie, a fast zombie movie together, which was like a decade before Dawn of the Dead. The Dawn of the Dead remake, unfortunately, which stole our idea. It was only really through that I started then investigating how to write screenplays and looking at that, because it's such a form-based mode of writing that it's very much about the actual structure of it and how it even looks on the page. And I had, as someone that hasn't read a script, it's quite hard to kind of even get into it first. And he had a script called Driver, which was about a serial killer that takes a bus hostage and wasn't able to sell it. So I kind of kept telling him about the theories of that I've been reading about, especially Douglas E. Winter's theories. And my thesis was essentially on postmodern horror and how it uses genre conventions to or it undermines genre conventions essentially, and plays with narrative form, and it plays with expectations. And I kept saying to him, "Well, this is why, this may be why it's not working. Why don't you try this? Why don't you try this?" And that script became Wolf Creek, the first one, and Greg was able to get funding for that, and went off, and I played one of the truckies in the truckers in the Roadhouse. We were kind of like the red herring bad guys, and which was great fun. And then when that was finished, he started developing. Well, he went back to a script that he'd written previously about a giant crocodile called Rogue. And we were talking about, I think we were talking actually about comic comic book ideas for continuing Wolf Creek, and so we came up with, you know, half a dozen ideas that we started developing, and then one of those I think we thought could really be something bigger, and so he sent me off to write that, and that was Wolf Creek 2. And so it was kind of a fluid process, but it was more that we were just so involved in that world at the time that we just had so many ideas that we came up with something we thought was good enough to be Wolf Creek 2. Then that took 9 years, I think, to get made. And in the meantime, he did make Rogue, and I was the script editor on that. So I actually still stayed involved in everything. And then finally got Wolf Creek 2 up, which was quite a magical experience. And especially as a writer, you tend to get sidelined in these things. But I was kept in the loop for the process, and I did another cameo in at the end of that as the police officer, getting to arrest the main actor, which was fun, and stayed in for the editing of that as well. And
was throughout the process.
Yeah, and was part of one of the voices for that, which is not typical. I think that most, and certainly in a lot of my other experiences writing screenplays has been that the writer is very much sidelined, and there's almost I think I had a producer say at one stage, you know, we're a necessary evil, which is a ridiculous thing to say about writers. It's like, you know, that
it does seem like a ludicrous thing, but no, I've heard from others that is, I'm certainly in Hollywood, and films other places, relatively common practice. Once the final script is in, then that's basically the end of the script writer's role. You know, like they're not on set at all. They're not. Yeah. That's it. They're done.
Yeah, I think there's a bit of resentment that they rely on us. That's just. Essentially, the writer often has to generate most of the content and the idea, and there's a real resentment at that. And so much of the industry is formed to take as much power away from those writers as possible, and that's the way that Hollywood's certainly has progressed over its lifetime.
Yeah,
and. Yeah, it's an extraordinary situation. I mean, you think, I've always thought that if you run into problems, certainly in the edit suite, yes, the editor, and generally they have a great understanding of story, but just having the original person that actually wrote all that there to bounce off, it's not a bad thing. You don't have to listen to all of it. And certainly when you have a number of voices in the room, then that writer's voice just becomes one of many. But it's how hard is that? Why is that I never understood that. I've come up against a number of instances where the writer's not respected, and those things generally show. I've just had an experience in a writer's room on a TV, possible TV series. And that was brilliant compared to it, because all voices are heard in that. And in television, the writer's God. In television,
that's what I was going to say. That it's a totally different, because like, and you know, it's a totally different thing. But in the States as well, because like, it's just the kind of the kind of cult of the showrunner. You know,
yes.
You know, so like, yeah, the writer is very much king in TV, but is like treated like shit in film. The only writers that seem to be respected in film are writer directors, and that's it. The other screenwriters are just seen as nothing.
And that's part of the problem, is whether you then have to branch out into directing just to stay in the process and to potentially have some control over the film. I mean, I've always thought, if you want control over your story, go back to fiction, because you don't really have that control, certainly not in film. you have some control on TV, but it's they're collaborative mediums. And I don't think that the power dynamic works in film, and that's the big problem. Whereas a lot of people I know have moved into the TV industry, and they have much more freedom. They have certainly they've got more security, but they've got more creative freedom as well, and they can do those big long stories, and they're the kind of the pressure is on them, but it's also that freedom as well. And I think with film, you're just trying to please other people all the time, and people that don't really want you there in sometimes. So it's saying that I've been working with some amazing producers in Adelaide, I've been working on a screenplay with them for a couple of years now, and we nearly got close last year with the lockdowns in Adelaide killed it, but we're hoping it comes back. But they've been fantastic. But they have a different attitude, I think, and they keep the writer informed of everything along the way. I think, you know, I've had experiences where producers hide things, and they they might hire another writer on something and without telling anybody, and those kind of betrayals don't do anyone favors. Whereas if you have an open producer that fights for you and keeps you in the loop, then you do whatever you can for them. You move heaven and earth for them, and I think that's a much better way to work. And I would do anything for them, I think.
I was going to ask, kind of cutting back to Wolf Creek 2 for just a minute. I was kind of interested in the decision to make it quite different from Wolf Creek. Wolf Creek 2 is kind of like, it almost does the Texas Chainsaw 2 thing of it's got a lot more, it's a lot more comical, very very dark comedy, but it's got a lot more of that. And
there's a few reasons. I think that partly for our own interests, but for me, coming in as being the writer of that, I think I didn't want it to be simply something that was about, killing women, essentially. So what I thought that this should be is something that wasn't expected. And I think that not that the first one was that, but I think there's an expectation in that sort of, I guess, a slasher type of movie that it kind of devolves into, it can devolve into, how can we kill women? So what I was bringing to that in some of the theories I've been doing and undermining generic expectations was, let's surprise the audience and set it up that this is going to be a certain way, which we have the two German backpackers at the start, and then all of a sudden it becomes a different type of story. And it, rather than torturing women, it was this one guy who was relentlessly pursued, Hitcher style, by Mick through the outback, and that became much more of an action type of idea. And we could have gone different routes, but for me, that was actually a conscious decision to try and make this different and to make it satirical. And that's probably why it feels more funny, because we're really taking the piss out of Mick in that film. And he's a xenophobic, ridiculous figure who spouts off about immigrants and refugees or whatever it is he talks about, because there is an undercurrent of that in Australian society, and we were parodying it. And I don't think a lot of people got it. Some early reviews absolutely got that and thought it was hilarious and got what we were trying to do. And then some that probably didn't view it properly or didn't. I think we had some reviewers here that refused to watch it just through sheer bias. Just didn't even give it that credit and didn't watch it on its own terms. And I think if they had, they would have seen that we were actually making a statement and talking about something in the Australian psyche. So there were a number of reasons there, and I don't know, whether that's what people expected or not, but it was certainly intentional. And if you think about, say, Texas Chainsaw 2 or Evil Dead 2, they're a different, very much a different tone, but both have very clear intentions of why they're doing that. And then certainly that was the case in Wolf Creek 2. It was a satire. And the first one, I don't think is a satire. I think the first one, Mick, he's got some great lines and he's funny in the first one, but he's uncomfortable too. He's that kind of exaggerated ochre character that does not. It's almost an insecure insecurity in that kind of really aggressive character that just wants to belittle and pull people down. And then Mick Taylor is someone who does that. Obviously a bit too far where he actually kills the people, but it's in the second one that just gets ramped up and he just becomes this kind of absolutely almost right-wing ridiculous figure.
I mean I think that does rewatching the film the other night there, I think that does come through. That is kind of working on the kind of that stereotype of like all the kind of worst aspects of like the stereotypical Australian bloke that I can recognize as somebody who's Scottish, who did live on the other side of the world for most of his life.
Well, I would have thought it was obvious, but then we got a lot of we got a bit of bad press at one stage from an actor in some crime series that was much more exploitative than Wolf Creek was, because it was actually revisiting real events in Victorian and New South Wales history, actual crime figures, and. He said we were like the sleaze merchants that were exploiting death or something or other. And it's like, so as I said, there's often a very biased and visceral reaction to horror, and the things that you try to do in it sometimes don't even get a chance to be aired because of that just intrinsic reaction that it can evoke, and you kind of spend all these years trying to do something interesting, only for people to only dismiss it in those terms. But I probably sound a bit defensive, but it was just disappointing because, as I said, there were a lot of people that got what we were doing, mm-hmm. and realized that it was a bit of fun. And and yes, there's some pretty extreme things in there, but it was for a purpose. It was to really, I guess, undermine certain aspects of the Australian psyche and Australian culture. And as I said before, that horror really allows that to happen because it's happening on such a kind of a purely emotional and almost physical form. It can get under your skin and work in a way that something that doesn't have those big strong moments doesn't do it the same way.
Yeah, I mean, I think you would think that, that the penny would drop in terms of the satirical element there with the Aussie history quiz.
That's
where
right.
Where Mick turns into like a kind of psychotic version of a right wing radio DJ.
Yep, that was all intentional.
The last thing though was in the original script, because it's like it's one of the maddest things you're likely to see if you've not seen Wolf Creek 2. But in the original script, was the kangaroo thing always there?
It's I don't know about in the early drafts, but it certainly came in. It certainly came in at one stage, and it was just one of those moments of, can we do this? But you know what? It's such an iconic, one of these iconic images that you're just not supposed to pull down in those ways. It's a bit like in the first one, you know, Greg parodied Crocodile Dundee by having the knife, saying, you know, this is, you know, it's not a knife, this is a knife. Yeah. Same thing. You pull down these revered figures, and that was just something that was so. Because it's an intense chase, and it just needed something like that. I think it got in the edit suite, and when they started putting in the kangaroos, it was only supposed to be one kangaroo, and then it became, you know, a whole block of them, and that I think that kind of it grew, but a lot of that stuff was we could sort of see those moments that could really really work on the audience and just play with people's expectations of Australia, because that's just not something you're supposed to do, is run over the kangaroos.
Yes, I can. Yeah, absolutely. it does. So, listeners, if you've not seen the movie, check that out. Check the film out. But like, it's one of the maddest things you'll see. So you mentioned a TV series that you've been working on, and this film in Adelaide that got put down because of COVID, but like you're still in production. Can you tell us anything about either of those projects, or is that something you need to keep under wraps?
Oh, you always have to keep things under wraps. It's one of the frustrating things. Whenever my family asks me things, I'm very vague. But I've been working on numbers of scripts in the last few years, working with a lot of different people, and still hopeful some of those things will work. The script set in Adelaide is, I guess I'd call it a folk horror, set in the Adelaide Hills, up in the sleepy, cold Adelaide Hills. I used to live in Adelaide for a while when I was younger, and I was always fascinated by the It's a very European and English area. It's very green, which is not usual. I always remember Adelaide as being very dry and brown and grey, but up in the hills, it's verdant and it's beautiful. But it's also, there's an edge to it, and it's also Adelaide's always had that history of weird sexual serial killing and various things that Salman Rushdie supposedly said it was the perfect place for a horror story or something like that. So I always thought that'd be a wonderful location for that. I've been asked to work on to develop a few different TV ideas recently. So there's one that's based on probably my favorite ever novel, by my favorite writer, and I'm not sure what will happen with that, but I've been developing that, and then working on this recent series, which is essentially a science fiction series, and so kind of moving out into different areas. But I think I'm working on a novel at the moment as well. So I think that the novel and the TV really correlate very well when you're talking about those long, expansive ideas. So I think that's a natural progression from novels to television. And I think I've always equated short stories and films more, because films are generally, they have one idea and they pursue that idea and then they get out, just like short stories, whereas novels don't always translate well to film because there's so many different little avenues off that. So I guess because I've been working on this novel for the last couple of years, that once the TV stuff has started coming in, I've really been looking at that as being something I'd like to pursue, and could really, you've got a lot more time, and you can start thinking in huge arcs. And I think the longer I write, the more I start thinking bigger ideas and multiple season TV series or even trilogy novels and various things. So I can't give you specifics, but
okay.
I mean, I've got short stories coming out. I've got one coming out in a literary Lovecraftian anthology soon. And there's always, I still write short stories when I can. I get asked every so often, and I don't always have time. But you mentioned Lee Murray, and she's commissioned a few things from me, and I think the last thing I wrote was actually for her, and that was a really fun story. It was the series is all supposedly subterranean horror, and so everyone else I think were doing things set in caves, so I did one that was an urban sort of drug raid that goes down to the bowels of this housing commission tower and starts finding some really weird stuff in there, just to be completely different from everybody else. So that was a lot of fun to write. And I've always liked police procedurals and things. And actually one of the TV series I'm developing is a police procedural.
Okay. Well, I know you can't give us any more details, so I won't probe any further on those. But I will say that I'll look forward to seeing them whenever they come out, and maybe we can have you back on the show, and we can talk about more things. I feel like that's a kind of good place to wrap up the interview, and it just leaves me to thank you very much for coming on the show today, and hope to talk to you again when all those things are out, the novel, the TV series, the film. Yeah,
let's hope. Thank you, Scott.
That was my guest Aaron there, who I'd like to thank once again for coming on the show. And as always, I'd like to thank you, listener, for tuning into this latest episode of New Horror Express. Remember, if you like what you heard, please be sure to rate, review, and subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get good podcasts. Unfortunately, that is all for this time, but be sure to join me next time when I will have another great guest from the world of indie horror. Until then, though, see ya.